It's Lars. Thank you for checking out my podcast, and have a great day.
You know, if I can digress for just a second, last night I was on the television. I was on the telephone with a person at an emergency hospital ward.
That is Joe Biden, and you're right. He doesn't always make very good sense. And in fact, I'm going to talk a little bit later on in the program today about the special favor that Joe Biden was trying to call in for a friend while he was on the phone to that hospital emergency ward. But first, welcome to First Amendment Friday. It's a key feature of the Lars Larson Show. One day every single week when you get a chance to sound off to the whole Pacific Northwest on the Radio Northwest Network. Glad to have you with me and always glad to take your calls. If you want to weigh in the best conversation and talk journalism, it's right here at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com and naysayers always go to the head of the line. And we've had some great naysayers this week. If you disagree with my point of view, that's okay. Unlike every other talk show on television or radio in America, this one actually affords you the opportunity to object to my point of view, to explain your own, and then to stick around for a few questions. As I was saying, Joe doesn't always make good sense, which kind of suggests that he doesn't exactly know what's going on all the time. I'm glad to have you join me for the day we celebrate everybody's freedom to speak out. But I want you to exercise that right now. As long as you're not afraid of the new announcement that outspoken people at public meetings like school boards are going to be targeted by the Joe Biden Department of Justice and Speech Suppression. That's the new name of the DOJ. This is such a crazy situation. Maybe the fact that Joe doesn't know what's going on is why just a couple of hours ago, we saw President Joe Biden trying so hard to spin the second worst jobs report so far this year. I'm not exaggerating. Let me tell you, the economists expected to see 500,000 new jobs in the month of September. Is that what they got? 500,000? No, the final number was 300,000 jobs less than that. So it was about a 60% miss by the Biden administration. But Joe Biden, babbling Joe, is trying to put a happy face on it. Listen to this.
The monthly totals bounce around, but if you take a look at the trend, it's solid. On average, 600,000 new jobs created every month since I took office. And in 3 months before I got there, that was one-tenth what was being created. It's 60,000 as opposed to 600,000 jobs a month. In total, the job creation in the first 8 months of my administration is nearly 5 million jobs. Jobs up, wages up, unemployment down. That's progress.
Now, Joe talks about a solid pattern. I'll point out the last 2 months have been massive failures, gigantic failures, where the economist said, we're going to get a lot of new jobs. And then they didn't get a lot of new jobs. This most recent failure, 194,000 new jobs, when they expected 500,000. Imagine trying to explain that to your boss. Boss, we expected to do 500,000 sales this month. We did 194,000. And we know last month was down too. That's a solid pattern. Yeah, it's a pattern going down. Do you know that women in the Joe Biden economy in the month of September actually lost 26,000 jobs? And it gets worse than that. Economists talk about something called, they always use fancy terms, labor force participation rate. Now, simply stated, that's the number of people still trying to find a job versus the ones who've simply said, chuck it. While America put 194,000 workers in jobs in September, almost as many, 183,000, said to hell with it and dropped out of the labor force altogether. And what does Joe say about that?
A drop of 496,000 in long-term unemployment is the second largest single-month drop since we started keeping records. The largest was in July. So in the past 3 months, we've seen a drop of 1.3 million long-term unemployed. That's the largest 3 months fall in long-term unemployment since we started keeping records in 1948. More to do, but great progress. And working Americans are seeing their paychecks go up as well.
Now, hold on a second. I know that Joe Biden has never had a job in the private sector. He went to college. He ran for politics. He got into the Senate. He stayed in the Senate for 36 years. He then was out for a while, becomes vice president to Barack Obama. He does 8 years of almost nothing and not paying attention to anything. Then he has a few years off, makes $13 million giving speeches in 2 years, and then he goes right back as president. He's never really had a real job. Maybe he doesn't understand that one of the reasons the number of people on unemployment is going down is because people are running out of their unemployment benefits. You can only do it so long. Now, economists said that any number, the number expected 500,000, the number delivered 194, any number below 200,000 would, quote, prompt investors to question the health of the economy. And because of Joe's failed policies, workers are struggling to get their jobs back. But worse than that, employers can't find workers. Do you know, I told you back in January there were 7.1 million open jobs in America. And I said, why don't we go out and fill those jobs? The unemployed can go to work. The answer was they were getting checks to stay home. And by May, it was 9 million. And then last month, I told you it was 10. This month, more than 11 million open jobs available and nobody to fill them. And Joe Biden wanted to force employers to require COVID vaccines. By the way, a mandate they have actually not even put on paper yet. And there are no plans to actually tell the American public when is OSHA going to adopt that rule. But Joe Biden, about those requirements on vaccines, take a listen to his point of view that if you threaten somebody's livelihood, you can actually get them to do something. Listen to how he talks about threats working.
These requirements work. And as the Business Roundtable and others told me, when I announced the first requirement, that encouraged businesses to feel they could come in and demand the same thing of their employees. More people are getting vaccinated. More lives are being saved. Let's be clear. When you see headlines and reports of mass firings and hundreds of people losing their jobs, look at the bigger story. I've spoken with Scott Kirby, CEO of United Airlines, who's here today. United went from 59% of their employees to 99% of their employees in less than 2 months after implementing the requirement. 99%.
Now, imagine this. Joe Biden is saying, hey, all you got to do is threaten people. Tell them you're going to be out of a job. You're not going to get unemployment. And by the way, you won't be able to find another job. If we threaten people enough, they'll actually do what we tell them to do. But Joe insists that government spending is the solution to all of this. Listen.
These bills are not about left versus right, or modern versus progressive, or anything else that pits Americans against one another. These bills are about competitiveness versus complacency. Competitiveness versus complacency. Opportunity versus decay. They're about leading the world, or whether we're going to let the world pass us by.
So, like every other problem in existence, a Democrat as president says the answer is more taxes and more government spending. To sum it up, wages are way up and so is inflation. So scratch that improvement. When you count in inflation, workers in America make less money this year than they did last year. Trillions of dollars in new taxes loom on the horizon, and this is not a good picture. Coming up, the Radio Northwest Network and the Northwest Nonsense on a First Amendment Friday.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to sit.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
No left-leaning, dead fish rapper bias. No mega TV network liberal agenda. Just the cold hard facts from Lars.
A few decades ago, as a reporter, I was talking to a state lawmaker, and that state lawmaker schooled me, but good, on the crazy idea, well, crazy at the time, of revoking a law that citizens had voted for. Ain't gonna happen, he told me. You don't cross the voters. Then 8 years ago, Oregon lawmakers overwhelmingly approved driver's licenses for illegal aliens. The very next year, citizens voted just as overwhelmingly by a 2-to-1 margin to reject the idea just passed by their so-called representatives. I told you about it at the time. I said, look, these are your state representatives who are supposed to represent you, and they've just done something by a 2/3 vote that when it was actually put to a public vote was rejected by a 2/3 vote. Lawmakers didn't get the message. So then 2 years ago, they repassed the very same law. You remember the one that they passed and then the voters unpassed it and told the voters to go to hell. That fall, the Secretary of State, Bev Clarno, allegedly a Republican, refused to let citizens put that back up for a vote. They know what happens when the citizens vote on things. They usually say something other than their so-called representatives do. Now we're seeing the same kind of treatment for capital punishment. In this case, in the state of Oregon, although I expect Washington State to follow. 70% of Americans approve of the death penalty, including solid majorities among black women and Democrat voters. Oregon voters have approved the death penalty two different times. Elected leaders or elected liberals don't like it. So 2 years ago, the alleged representatives of the people voted to trim down the death penalty like a fat hog. They made a law that means, as a practical matter, the capital punishment will never be used again. And now the courts, including judges not chosen by the voters, plan to put the death penalty to death. But they don't plan to ask the voters because they know it would win solid approval at the ballot, so they'll just get rid of it. California tried that a couple of years ago, vastly outspent the pro-death penalty folks. Guess who won? Pro-death penalty. That's what the public wants. If you get the impression that our so-called government service servants and elected leaders, representatives they call themselves, if you get the impression they don't give a damn what you think, you're absolutely right. Now on Getter, Gary wrote in because he heard me describing President Biden's spokeswoman as Peppermint Patty. Lars, I just need to say it's wrong to call Jen Psaki Peppermint Patty. It is pronounced Eppermint Addy. The P is silent. Thanks for all you do. And on Facebook, Jim Miguel says, Lars, there's no way I believe that Hunter Biden, the druggie, painted all those paintings that he gets credit for. Prove it by a public display of his painting technique. Otherwise, get us the picture of the Chinese painter that actually painted those pictures. And on Twitter, the New York Times had to issue a massive correction. They had published stories telling people how many children had been hospitalized because of COVID infection. It turns out that the New York Times made a minor little mistake. They overstated the number of kids sent to the hospital by about 800,000. Good mistake. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Find out right now. Brought to you by Les Schwab Tire Centers. Doing the right thing matters.
Well, I haven't given it to him in a while, but I'm going to give today's Daily Grill to Oregon Senator Ron White. Now, I have to point out, it's only fair to tell you, he actually makes his home 2,500 miles away in New York City with his wife and small children. He's criticized the report that came out that said all of those so-called racial justice protesters in Portland last summer, the ones that were supposedly mostly peacefully protesting as people were getting, well, sent to the hospital, buildings were burning, cops were being assaulted. The Department of Homeland Security was apparently targeting them last summer. They were actually keeping an eye on people who are committing crimes in the streets of the city. And Ron Wyden says, this is all about politics. He's very outraged. Well, let me point out what Senator Wyden of New York City does and doesn't like. The New York-based senator does not like Homeland Security keeping an eye on people who staged 100 nights of riots with arson, assault, and even a murder, along with millions of dollars in property damage. But Wyden did not object to Homeland Security and the FBI keeping an eye on and even infiltrating the people who caused damage in a single day of riot at the U.S. Capitol in January. Didn't have a problem with that. And Wyden has not objected to this week's news that Biden Attorney General Merrick Garland has announced the FBI and the DOJ will target parents and kids, most of them conservative, who show up at school board meetings to complain about political indoctrination of their kids into racist ideas like CRT, along with a lot of BLM and Antifa propaganda. So Senator Wyden doesn't mind that the DOJ is going to target ordinary citizens who go to school board meetings, but he very much objects to the idea that the Department of Homeland Security would keep an eye on rioters and people who engage in looting and assault and even murder. Today's best email, but you can always send more to talk@LarsLarson.com. Brought to you by River City Environmental, a leading environmental and emergency services company in the Northwest. Now hiring with full benefits, leading pay, and a signing bonus. Find them online at rivercityusa.com/careers. Kyle Lukes of Bellingham, and he says sadly of Bellingham, writes, Lars, I love your show. Keep up the hard work. The question is, when states and the federal government lay off employees due to not getting the jab, will these people then not be eligible for unemployment and therefore not count toward unemployment numbers? Kyle, the answer to that is no, they won't get unemployment, and no, they won't be counted as unemployed. So they won't be Joe Biden's problem, just like he was saying today. To your calls on this First Amendment Friday, let's start with Ron. Hey, Ron, thanks for listening on the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
I'm calling in response to the nurse that called in and said she was going to lose her job the next day.
Yeah, we've had a few of them over the last few weeks.
You know about, Sinovac made a vaccine called CoronaVac, and it's not available in the U.S., and I wrote both our U.S. senators and one state senator, but I never got replies.
What's the name of the vaccine again?
CoronaVac by the company Sinovac, and it is the old school inactivated virus. And the folks, seems like they wouldn't have to lose their jobs if they would be able to get this thing. So I've talked to my friends.
Except Ron, if I'm right, usually when you see the word S-I-N-O, Sino, it refers to something having to do with China. I'm guessing, I haven't looked up that company, but I will look them up. I suspect they're a Chinese company. Would you trust a Chinese vaccine?
Yeah.
You would? Why? Why in the world? Yeah. Why?
Well, because it's an inactivated virus, for one thing. The other, mRNA, that's pretty much a designer drug. But you understand what an inactivated virus is, right?
I know exactly what it is. It's how most vaccines are made. But who?
Correct.
I'm just curious why you'd trust. Let's see, it's a Chinese biopharm company. John, Ron, if you would trust a Chinese vaccine, I'm not sure. I think you should go back and rethink that one, although that's just my personal opinion, and I very much appreciate your call. Coming up, how can Americans fight back against big tech censorship? We'll talk to a candidate coming up next. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's First Amendment Friday. You know, I just saw that apparently Facebook and some other social media have been hit by another outage today, just like the one a couple of days ago. I'm not quite sure how big it is. We'll get you details as it becomes available. But I had planned to talk about big tech with Joe Kent, who is currently one of the Republican candidates who is running to replace Jamie Herrera Butler, Rhino Republican in Washington's 3rd Congressional District. Joe is a retired Special Forces Warrant Officer and the Gold Star husband of fallen soldier Shannon Kent. Joe, welcome back to the program. Let's talk about big tech, because this entity has become far too important, not just in politics, but in commerce and in just letting Americans know what's really going on in their world. So how do we fight back against this, and how would you do it if you become the new congressperson from the 3rd Congressional District?
Yeah, thanks so much for having me back on, Lars. I think this is a really important issue. The big tech has become this massive monopoly like we've never seen in America before. So it's obviously, first and foremost, a huge threat to our First Amendment, because it has become the modern public square. We have these oligarchs that essentially can say who can and who can't speak in our public square. But it goes far beyond that. As you mentioned, there's control of bank accounts and pretty much access to modern life as we know it. And they are the gatekeepers. And right now they're combining with the federal government in a very, I think, alarming way, the way that Facebook has been being used to look at content that's counter to the narrative about COVID, counter to the narrative about what happened on January 6th. It's really combined with the left wing and with the Democrats in a way that has made it this monopoly that we just have to break up. So I would break up big tech. I'm all for Section 230 reform, but I don't think it goes far enough. I think we need to break it up, treat it as a common carrier, as a public utility, and go after it with antitrust, anti-monopoly laws.
See, I'd go with that, too. I mean, Section 230's got to go. if these companies say we can't exist without Section 230, if they become publishers, but that's really what they've made themselves into is publishers. I don't deny that this show, Joe, is a publication in the eyes of the law, just like a newspaper, a television program. I'm responsible for all the content, and I have to take that responsibility along with having the show. Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, the rest do not have to take that. They get a special carve-out that was created by the United States government. With that carve-out, they have agreed to behave in a certain way. And as you point out, just this week, YouTube announced that it is no longer going to allow anybody to voice opinions that are counter on climate change, that show skepticism about climate change, counter opinions on vaccines or the response to COVID and a host of other things. They're being bold enough that it tells me they no longer care if they act like censors because they're doing it right out in front of God and everybody.
That's exactly right. So recently my YouTube channel was deleted, permanently suspended, I guess. So we didn't get any warning, any strikes. I'm not sure exactly what the last strike was, but we woke up about 2 or 3 days ago. We're trying to upload some content, and we got the warning or the notice that YouTube had taken down our channel for violating community standards or whatever that means. So, I mean, really, I think it's just that these people want to show us that they have control over speech, and they want to intimidate people that need to make a living via big tech or on the internet in general into conforming. And that's where we're at right now, not to mention the data sharing that's going on between all these carriers and the federal government to really target people that dissent from the current narrative.
All right. So your approach is take away 230 or modify it substantially and then go after them through antitrust kinds of actions like any other private company is subject to.
That's right. Yeah. So they've essentially become a common carrier like the phone companies used to be and currently are. That everyone needs access to. And so I think the government should break them up. Eminent domain, there's a clear eminent domain case there because everyone needs to exist in the digital space, but then also using antitrust law and anti-monopoly law to break them up. They shouldn't have this much power. These tech oligarchs have become entirely too powerful. This is a place where the federal government really needs to exert its control over them and ensure that our citizens actually have access to the internet and is not controlled by a handful of tech oligarchs.
I'm talking to Joe Kent. Joe, what's your website real quick? And I want to ask you about Jamie Herrera Butler.
JoeKentForCongress.com.
JoeKentForCongress.com. We've talked to all the candidates. Joe's running for the nomination, but Jamie Herrera Butler would like to get her job back for another 2 years. She is running, and she's been on this show to talk about it, and she's always invited back. I've told her staff that she's – and if people say, well – but you'll ask her hard questions, or you've been critical of her. Joe knows that I'll be critical of him if he gets the gig and then starts doing things that I disagree with. I'm going to say so, and my callers may say so as well. Let me ask you about something that was announced this week that I almost couldn't wrap my head around. There are times where you think, what if a president or his attorney general announces this, and you say, no, nobody's crazy enough to do that. The attorney general, who has family ties, his son-in-law works for a company that pushes CRT propaganda, critical race theory propaganda, on schools and makes money from it. So he's got a dog in the fight. He should have recused himself out. But he comes out and announces that he's going to go after ordinary citizens who show up at school board meetings. And this is happening here in the Northwest and elsewhere around the country to complain about, which they have a right to do, to their local school board, critical race theory, propaganda, Antifa, BLM, Planned Parenthood, a whole range of ideas. And the school boards are saying, we don't like being criticized. And they say, we don't like being harassed. Well, unfortunately, being in public office, you should be free of physical threats to your safety. Other than that, any criticism any citizen wants to make of you, short of that, should be legitimate. So what do we do when the attorney general says we're going to crack down on citizens who complain to their local school board?
We have to not take the bait. They want us to do one of two things. They want everybody right now who is protesting against what's going on in schools, from the CRT to the mask mandates, and then people that are questioning the narrative regarding the election and everything else that the left and the Biden administration is trying to push down our throats. They want us to either stop coming out, stop showing up, stop mobilizing, stop participating in our democratic process, or they want us to act foolishly so they can turn the full scope of law enforcement against us. We need to not take that bait. Continue to show up peacefully. at all these different school board meetings. Let your voices be heard. We pay these people salary. They need to hear exactly how we feel about masks in place in our kids, indoctrination and propaganda being taught to our children. And then we have the right to protest our government at every single level. I think this ties directly in with the social media oligarchs. They want to silence any dissent from the regime right now. We're on the cusp of losing our republic. And if we don't start speaking out, continuing to organize, and that includes getting out, registering, and voting, we will lose our republic. So I really encourage people not to be intimidated, not to take the bait.
You know, it's funny because, Joe, I can count back 25 years to telling people, they'd say, I want to get involved. I said, run for the school board. They said, well, that's not quite me. I said, then support somebody else who's running for the school board who send the same values as you. Go out and knock on doors or make phone calls or do whatever they need you to do. You know, it doesn't have to be money. It can be your time. And if you don't do that, if you don't do either one of those, go to the school board meeting, be aware of what they're doing, and bring these things to their attention and tell them what you think. At the very least, do that. And lately, I've been telling people, bring a friend. Say what you're going to say reasonably and peacefully. It can still be strong without having profanity or things like that in it, and have them video it and put it up on screen. We've seen videos like that from all over America, you know, and all kinds of parents, you know, and grandparents showing up saying, you can't do this to our kids. And when it goes viral, I think that's what's caused the School Boards Association to object to this. And frankly, I'd like to see every school board in America quit that organization as a signal to them. Tell me what you think.
No, absolutely. We need people to show up. Let them know how they feel about what's going on right now. Get involved as much as possible. And then I think we need to push heavily for school choice, school vouchers, because right now these school boards, they know that at the end of the day that we don't actually have any power over them other than the power of protest. We need the ability to pull our children out and have the money follow them so that they actually have to come to the negotiating table and hear our voices, or they will lose their funding. That's the only way, I think, to really restore the balance of power between us, the parents, and these school boards.
Absolutely right. That's Joe Kent running for Congress against Jamie Herrera Butler. He'll beat her in the Republican Party. He'll be the next congressman from the 3rd Congressional District. It's First Amendment Friday. Your call's up next. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a First Amendment Friday. Always glad to get your phone calls and your emails, too, at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. I have to remind you that a few weeks ago, we talked to an attorney who was representing Oregon State Police Troopers, and they had gone to court seeking to overturn the governor's order that it was either vax, no jab, no job. If you didn't take the vaccine, you were going to be fired. Now, I've pointed out that both Oregon and Washington have been crippling their states, not just government, but they've also been crippling private institutions like schools and hospitals as well with this no vax, no jab, no job mandate. Well, the state troopers went to court, and the Supreme Court said, nope. The judge said, we're not going to allow you to do that. The governor's power is apparently, well, it knows no bounds. So that was rejected. And unfortunately, that was the case. It is First Amendment Friday. Glad to get your calls. If you want to jump into the best conversation in talk journalism, it happens right here on the Radio Northwest Network, which has now been serving the Pacific Northwest for almost 22 years. That'll be true in January of next year. We'll hit 22 years of service to the states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. Our Twitter poll today: should government gut the death penalty for the worst killers without asking the voters? I'd say no to that. You've heard my take on the death penalty. I think the death penalty was and is appropriate. It was chosen by the voters. It was certified by, cleared by the U.S. Supreme Court and the state courts as being a legitimate penalty. We've had Democrat governors like Kitzhaber before he got forced out of office for corruption by his girlfriend. And we've had Kate Brown say, and Jay Inslee, all say, I'm simply not going to enforce the law. And then you saw state lawmakers that didn't have the guts to say to the voters, we want you to get this law off the books. So they decided to simply disassemble it as much as they could. The death penalty is still officially on the books in the state of Oregon, but the set of circumstances required for somebody to be found guilty of a murder, it'd have to be multiple murders. It has to be done as part of a terrorist activity. It's a crazy set of rules. If you looked at them, it's easy without even being a lawyer to understand They've engineered this so that nobody will ever face the death penalty again. Now, I know that some of you don't like the death penalty. That's okay. You have to understand the vast majority of people in Oregon and Washington and around the United States favor the death penalty, about 70% support for it. So if the state lawmakers are going to do this, if they're going to gut the death penalty through a combination of legislative actions, governor inaction by refusing to enforce the law, and then judges who step in and supplement the people's point of view with their own personal point of view, should they at least ask the voters? You know, should they gut the death penalty without doing that? And my answer to that is no, it should be put to a vote. You see, the liberals don't have the guts to put it to a vote because they know what the vote's going to be. They watched what happened in California less than a half dozen years ago when the anti-death penalty people outspent the pro-death penalty people about 10 to 1 and still lost massively in a liberal state like California. People in Oregon and Washington saw that and said, we're not going to put that thing to a vote up here. The voters will approve it, and then we'll have to do something about it. Today's Twitter poll, at Lars Larson Show, or on our website at LarsLarson.com, and brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Now, let's go to Russ in Coopville, Washington. Hey, Russ, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Well, what's on my mind is when I watch the video, and I've seen it quite a few times, with Kristen Sinema in that restroom.
The senator from Arizona. And she was followed into a restroom by a creepy person who videoed this harassment, which, as I've said, harassment of threats against public officials not allowed. Harassment, you can harass them all you want. You can yell at them. You can get your point of view across. What was your take on it?
My take was it brought back memory of Gabby Giffords. And
well,
I don't hear anybody talking about that.
Hold on, but Russ, following somebody into a bathroom and shooting video is not the same as shooting somebody in the head with a gun. You're really comparing those two?
Well, no, what I'm comparing is I kind of got the feeling that something like that could have happened.
Well, how? Did you think that the man's... Because, Russ, that's an unreason... This is like people who compare things to the Nazis, and I say the Nazis were mass murderers. Unless you're talking about a mass murderer, I don't like the comparison. When you say following a politician with a video camera outside a bathroom, following them into a bathroom is creepy and weird, but it's not anywhere near like shooting them with a gun, is it? Are you really saying that?
No. Well, that was just the feeling I got.
The feeling you got was that somehow the person's video or their cell phone, could turn into a gun?
Well, no, it was just kind of the way with what happened to Gabby Giffords, the guy kind of out of nowhere.
Well, the guy shot her. The guy shot Gabby Giffords. He tried to kill her. He's been convicted of that. So the guy shoots somebody with a gun, and you think that's the same as following a politician with a video camera? I mean, I'd agree with you if you said it's creepy and weird to follow somebody into a bathroom.
It was creepy and weird.
But it's not deadly.
It just looks like it could have been.
What'd you think of Joe Biden saying that's just part of the process and she should deal with it?
I didn't like it, actually.
Yeah, because it's also creepy and weird. But then again, we have a president who's creepy and weird. He's a neck sniffer, you know. You got the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a First Amendment Friday, my favorite day of the week, not because it ends the week, but because it begins your opportunity. One day a week, we set aside and say every subject is fair game. Now, of course, we always entertain naysayers, but Angela Erickson is not a naysayer. I actually find myself in agreement with Angela Erickson. She works at the Pacific Legal Foundation as its strategic research director. And I want to talk to her about the crisis that is being created artificially in healthcare by the actions of governors who've simply said, we're going to tell people, doctors and nurses and such, if you don't get the jab, you're not going to have a job. And on top of that, there are some states that use something called certificate of need, which says that a private institution like a hospital has to be directed by the government and allowed or not allowed to expand its capacities if you thought, well, Every other private business is able to do this, restaurants, hotels, things like that. But when it comes to healthcare, we've got government sticking its nose into it, at least in the state of Oregon, saying you have to ask the state pretty please if you want to expand your capabilities. Angela, welcome back to the program.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I want to add to that description of certificate in need. Not only do you have to ask the government, we like to call it a competitor's veto because your competitors get to protest your entrance, and that helps determine whether the government is going to let you build a facility, expand, add equipment. It's crazy.
It is crazy, and it has an impact on price, doesn't it, Angela?
Yeah, so states with these laws, healthcare costs are higher as like a per service, but also overall.
So how many states have what are they called, con laws, certificate of need laws? Is Oregon the only one?
So there are about 38 states that have con laws, but it varies from like Arizona just has it for ambulances, and then other states have it for a dozen or more things. And so it varies widely across the U.S., but among the states that have it, two-thirds of them suspended those laws during COVID. Oregon is not one of those states. It's still in the books in Oregon, and it's preventing hospitals from adding beds when they need them.
Well, and that seems especially weird because, Angela, one of the questions I've been asking rhetorically this year is when hospitals say, my goodness, we're short of staff. Well, they've created a lot of that problem themselves along with the governors. But if they say we're short of certain kinds of beds, I would think, you know, I asked the question rhetorically. I was aware of the certificate of need laws. But if a hospital had said last year when they were threatened with, say, running out of ICU space, could a hospital on its own without going to the governor say, we already have a hospital, it already has general rooms, maternity rooms, ICU rooms, other kinds of specialty things. Could they have said, we ought to double our capacity in the ICU. We ought to have twice as many ICU beds that we could open up if we need them, having nearly come to a shortage of them once already in 2020. Could they have done that and said, we're going to expand our capacity?
No, they wouldn't have been able to do so. They would have had to go through this process of applying for a certificate of need, which takes months or years. In the meantime, other states have said, we're suspending that law altogether. We're going to set up field tents in fields. We're going to set up beds in conference centers. And you haven't been able to do that in Oregon because this law is sitting on the books preventing the expansion of just hospital beds. Something as simple as a bed.
And yet, Angela, since it works to the, I would guess that at times it works to the benefit of many or most of the players, meaning the hospitals and the clinics. So they have a law that benefits them when it keeps their competition from adding extra space. Did the hospitals get together and go to the state of Oregon and say, hey, by the way, get this law out of our way so that even if we don't actually create the ICU beds, we create the opportunity that if in a, you know, short-term need, and it doesn't have to be a pandemic. It could be an earthquake. It could be a major storm. It could be a lot of other calamities that might see the need for a dramatic expansion of ICU beds. Give us the approval ahead of time so that if we need to quickly double our ICU capacity, we can do it. Are the hospitals even asking for it?
I mean, if they were asking for it, it would have happened, right? The hospitals are incredibly powerful, right? And we want to, and especially at times like right now, we want to support them and the staff so that they can take care of us when we need them. But they haven't asked for it, and I suspect partially is because they don't want the law to end. In states that are continuing to hold on to these laws, lots of states are fighting to get rid of them. What you hear are the hospital administrators and the hospital associations coming out and saying that they're necessary despite 40 years of evidence that shows it does more harm than good in several states that don't even have the laws on the books.
Is there a way to beat it legally, or is there a way to get the law changed, or is there just not the political will to do that?
So there is political will in some states. Florida changed their laws a couple years ago. Tennessee is in the process of changing their laws. Montana is working to change their laws. So there are states doing it through the legislature. And then, of course, there are several organizations, including Pacific Legal Foundation, which are suing about these laws. We have a case in Louisiana for a respite care facility and an ambulance case in Kentucky. And we're just waiting for a judge to realize that this type of imposition isn't valuable for government to do, that it's actually harming government or harming our citizens more than it is helping.
I mean, because Angela, one of the things I've also spitballed with my audience, I've said, listen, if you know that you're coming up to a surge of COVID or, you know, any other kind of calamity, and you say, we're a hospital, we've already shut down our elective surgery temporarily while we're dealing with a, you know, a short-term event like the most recent surge of COVID, let's take some of our regular hospital beds. We'll add ventilators. We'll add all the other specialized equipment that you use in an ICU room, because the ICU is just, it's a room with some specialized equipment and specialized personnel, right? Yeah, I mean, if you have those two things, almost any room could become an ICU.
And I guarantee you that hospitals and doctors want to be able to do that. But the question is, do they want to be able to do that at the cost of potentially removing that law altogether?
Which would be so the people in the C-suite, the corner office of the hospital, are saying, no, keep it there. It keeps our competition from competing with us, and it keeps the prices high, effectively. And when Kate Brown says, why, we might run out of hospital space, she's the person who seized emergency control of the state, and she thinks she can order just about anything under the sun. And she has, and the courts have backed her up. If she wanted to get rid of this law, either temporarily or somewhat permanently, she could do it. So are you saying she's effectively a hypocrite?
Yeah, most of the governors have actually suspended these laws, right? And it's actually the evidence in the early days of COVID is that the suspension of these laws saved lives. Whereas in states like Oregon and other states that didn't suspend those laws, they saw more deaths.
Right? Well, so you know what? For Democrat governors, you've got Cuomo, you've got Inslee, you've got Kate Brown. They're all potential killers in my book. Angela Erickson is the strategic research director at the Pacific Legal Foundation. It's First Amendment Friday. I'll get to your phone calls coming up next. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a First Amendment Friday, live on the Radio Northwest Network, going out to every corner of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. Our Twitter poll today, should the government gut the death penalty for the worst killers without even asking the voters? I'd say no to that. You can vote any way you like, at Lars Larson Show on Twitter. If you don't like Twitter, like me, go to my website at LarsLarson.com. Brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. Yesterday, I asked you, should we put school resource police officers back in Northwest schools to protect your kids? I said yes. So did 92% of you. Only 8% of you said no. And yet, Seattle schools, Portland schools, they're all giving the bum's rush to school resource officers. Even Vancouver schools in my neck of the woods, they've said no. We don't want the cops there. And then when somebody shows up with an AR-15, which happened this week in Seattle, it was detailed in the Post-Millennial by my friend Ari Hoffman, who does the show on our Seattle affiliate, KVI, that immediately follows me in the afternoons. He did the story. The school knew that two people in a car drove up, had an AR-15, loaded it in front of witnesses, pointed it out the window at some of the students who were out there returning from lunch. So this was in the middle of the day, and the school didn't even tell the parents for about 24 hours about what had happened. And then they had to call 911. And why did they have to call 911? Because they don't have a school resource officer anymore. And if that seems foolish to me, to you, I would agree with you. If you want to jump into the best conversation and talk journalism, you're certainly welcome at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. Let's go first to Kevin. Hey, Kevin, thanks for listening. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lars. I'm a nurse. I work at a small critical access hospital down here. And I actually learned from your show about the State Board of Nursing's hearings that they're going to have, where they're going to introduce a bill or an act where they can have refusal of the mandatory vaccine being derogatory against nurses and fine them and actually sanction their license. after hearing that on your show, I went to the OSBN site, looked into the hearing and their rulemaking, and they defer you to OHA, which is the Oregon Health Authority.
Yep.
So if you go there, they say, well, the governor has instituted this executive order, has directed us to make these rules, and then they direct you to Boley, the Bureau of
Labor and Industries.
The Labor Bureau, exactly.
Yep.
And so they say, well, you can't claim, and they list off the things, and the 1989 law is not affected here because state or federal statutes, rules, and regulations supersede those. But there's no statutes and no regulations that have been.
Nope.
So then you go to the rules and what rulemaking says, and specifically in the rulemaking, it says that executive orders and interagency memos can't be used as a basis for rulemaking. Yet,
yep,
all these rules are being made, and so
you kind of get the picture that they're starting to cheat around the edges, don't you, Kevin?
Yes, sir. Definitely.
Well, look, there's something I've noticed, and it seems to be done. When the Republicans do it, I'll call them out on it too, Kevin. But I want to point out to you a pattern that's been happening, and I think what you're talking about speaks to it. So you remember there was a guy named Brett Kavanaugh who was put up to be on the U.S. Supreme Court. He actually made it.
Right.
But do you remember when they told a bunch of lies about him?
Right.
Okay. They had women. First woman, one woman came forward with a crazy story, which turned out to be a lie. But in some cases, if you approach something by saying, it does, people don't have to believe it forever. They just have to believe it long enough to get rid of Brett Kavanaugh. That was the approach. So when her story failed, they put up a second woman, and her story was even crazier. And then they put up a third woman who talked about rape rings and drug deals and all this stuff. And it was even crazier. But their theory is the lie doesn't have to stick for very long, just long enough. And you say, well, that's once. I said, well, let's see. Was the Russia collusion hoax, was that real? And we saw, you know, 2-3 years of investigation, $40 million. And even Robert Mueller, who's a friend of Democrats, came back and said, no, there's nothing to that either. But it didn't need to be believed for very long. The lie only had to work long enough. Well, now what we have, and I'll point out, several weeks ago now, Joe Biden came out on a Friday night. I think it was a Friday night, might have been a Thursday night, and he announced, I'm going to tell every company in America they have to tell their employees to get vaccinated. And the question was, well, how are you going to do that? And they said through OSHA, you know, or Occupational Safety and Health Administration. Well, the problem is, for weeks since then, the reporters have been saying, hold on a second, where's the rule? And they say, well, it hasn't been written yet. And you say, well, when are you going to write it? And there's no sign that the White House, the White House said, we'll have it for you Monday. They keep saying, well, we're going to write it one of these days. That's it.
Right.
And the problem is
a new process.
Well, except, Kevin, look how this works. And this, you know, I know people, I don't like conspiracy theories either, unless the facts suggest it's real. If the president comes out and announces this is happening, and he gets every company in America, for the most part, to say, well, the rule's coming at us, we better go out and start doing what the rule says before the rule's even written. And if the rule never gets written, and there are some predictions right now that rules like this have never survived the court challenges. So in other words, Joe Biden is saying, I've got a rule, it doesn't even exist yet. We're gonna slow walk the process of writing the rule. In the meantime, we get everybody to do what we said the rule is going to say when it exists, if it ever exists. And if a month or 2 months from now, they say, by the way, we never actually wrote that rule. Or we wrote a rule and it's going to get beat in court as soon as it gets to court, but it can't go to court until you actually have a copy of the rule. I mean, you can't go to your lawyer and say, I'd like to go to court and challenge this rule. Your lawyer says, well, where's the rule? You go, well, they haven't written it yet. They're not going to write it for weeks or months or who knows. Maybe it'll be written next year. Your lawyer's going to say, I can't go to the court and ask them to overrule a rule that doesn't exist yet. So you can't even start challenging it till then. In the meantime, everybody is complying with the rule. Now, does that sound like a legitimate way to do business, Kevin?
Not at all.
It doesn't to me either. And I think it fits right in with the lie about Kavanaugh. If somebody believes a lie long enough, we can kill Kavanaugh's appointment. Lie about Trump, we can keep him from being elected. Lie about him after he's been elected, maybe we can cripple his presidency for a few years while the whole hoax is being investigated. And when it turns out there was nothing there to begin with, well, you can't go back and undo the harm you've done. And when you tell a bunch of companies, by the way, that rule never happened. Oh, yeah, but we already fired our doctors, our nurses, our airline pilots, our paramedics, our cops, our, in Washington State, our ferry pilots, because, what, they've had a couple of hundred ferries that never left the dock this week. Why? They don't have enough employees. Why? Because of a rule that the president said he was going to write that never happened. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm always glad to get your phone calls and your emails. I want to talk about Taiwan just a bit, because there seem to be signs right now that mainland China, the communist China, is going to invade Taiwan, which is, of course, the free China, the China that elects its own leaders, that has a representative form of government much like ours, the one that is one of the most productive countries on planet Earth. It is a tiny country, 13,000 square miles. It's not very big. It's smaller than an awful lot of American states, and it only has about 24 million people, less than 10% of the U.S. population. But they are incredibly productive, and they put the mainland Chinese to shame with their productivity. But now it seems that with Joe Biden, I call him Beijing Joe because he seems to kowtow to the Chinese a lot, with Joe Biden in place as commander-in-chief in the United States, the mainland Chinese have become more and more belligerent, literally, over just a space of months. I thought we'd talk about that with Colonel Robert Wilkie, who is the former VA secretary under Donald Trump and a visiting fellow at Heritage. Colonel, welcome back to the program.
Well, thank you, Lars. Thank you for having me. And I'm going to add something to my biography, which is pertinent to your conversation. When Secretary Mattis was Secretary of Defense, I was the Undersecretary of Defense for Readiness. So that's actually my world more than VA. But what you said is absolutely on target. We've seen the attempts at intimidation of free China go up exponentially since President Biden came to office. And they've even ramped up since the disaster in Afghanistan. The mainland Chinese, the communist Chinese, are telling anyone in that region, you can't trust the United States. They just ran out on an ally of 20-something years and left their own people behind. And if they do that, how can they be expected to defend you? And you'd better get on board with Xi's visions of a greater China. That's what's really going on.
I agree with you. And by the way, do you mind if I add, Colonel, some of the people we left behind are school children from the Sacramento area. I mean, if you say, well, we left some NGO types and some, you know, people who were working for the Red Cross or whatever. No. We left school kids behind from the United States in Afghanistan. And I don't know, Colonel, I've been working in news so long, I remember when one kid down a well somewhere in America would cause round-the-clock news coverage. We've got dozens of school kids from Sacramento stuck behind Taliban lines with one of the most evil groups on the planet, and the major media barely mentions it. The LA Times did because it's in their neighborhood. Let's go to this, though. I read today as well a report at SOF, which is one of the sites I go to look for military developments. They say we've already put green berets on the ground in Taiwan to help that country train up and get ready for a possible amphibious invasion of the country. Right. Is it that dire?
Well, look, my view is that China would love for there to be a revolution in thought on Taiwan, where they just throw their hands up and say this is inevitable. It still will take a lot more than the Chinese now have to come across 110 miles of ocean. I mean, there's a reason that the United Kingdom or England has not been invaded since 1066, and they're only separated from Europe by 23 miles. It's awfully hard to mount that kind of assault. However, they are building toward that capability. And just a few special forces on the ground is not going to change the calculus. What's going to change the calculus is our ability to supply Taiwan with the means to make the calculus change in Beijing. So what do I mean? That means turn the island into a porcupine of anti-ship and anti-aircraft missiles, mines by the thousands, so that it's almost impossible to come across those straits without a terrible cost. The other side of this is that we have to arm our friends. China is surrounded by nations that have felt a 1,000 years of Chinese imperialism and aggression. I mean, in our lifetime, Lars, China's fought wars with India, too. It's fought a war with Vietnam when we were youngsters. It lost that one. So people are looking to the United States. The sad thing is that the Chinese, the communists, have already taken the measure of this president and particularly his State Department. I'll give you an example. The 100th anniversary of the Chinese Communist Party was July 1st. What does the Secretary of State do? He sends them a Hallmark greeting congratulating them on the 100th anniversary of the birth of one of the most savage regimes in human history. I mean, this is a regime that since 1949 has killed at a minimum 100 million of its own people. And yet the Secretary of State thinks that that cause is worthy of celebration.
Well, I mean, Colonel, when you have Jen Psaki speaking on behalf of Joe Biden, describing the Taliban, who are now hanging people from, you know, from cranes in downtown Kabul and allowing this to be a public display to the rest of the world. And she calls them businesslike, you know, that they operate in a businesslike manner. I guess depending on what kind of business you're talking about, that is businesslike. You could have described Al Capone as very businesslike. When his competition got in the way, he killed him. But you're saying that we need to win this war before it even starts by just communicating to the Chinese. If you do this, it's going to be so darned expensive in human terms and in every other way. I've also had some people suggest to me, some of the security types I talked to, Colonel, say the reason that China's going through some blackouts right now where their power plants get turned off is because China is bracing for the day when the rest of the world says, we're not selling you coal. So they're turning off some of their coal plants to get their population ready for that. Is that possible?
Yeah, it is possible. And, you know, my former boss, Secretary of Defense Gates, used to tell me that the one thing that the Chinese communists fear more than anything else, their own people. What you're seeing in China, which is not reported, is that every day there is more and more unrest, particularly industrial unrest. People have finally figured out that they can't give up some freedom in exchange for material benefit, because that benefit is drying up. Xi is playing an old game. It's not even a Chinese game. It's simple power politics. His economy is teetering. I mean, he has the worst debt to GDP ratio in the world. And the problems at home, energy included, as you said, are mounting. So he's trying to divert attention by stirring up foreign problems. In addition to that, you know, tying into his vision of a greater China, he wants to be thought of more highly than Mao in the Chinese pantheon. But we have an opportunity. I don't think we'll fulfill it under this president, but we have to arm China's neighbors. We have to bring the British, the French, the Indians into this equation. And the other thing we need to do is we need to rethink our strategic posture. I'll give you an example. We have not had a fleet-on-fleet naval action since Okinawa in 1945. Our fleet was designed for a fleet-on-fleet action with the Soviet Navy, but that disappeared in 1991. Since that, the Navy has become, and I say this with all respect, really a troop carrier for the United States Marine Corps. Yeah. We have to reorient the Navy. We have to put more submarines in the water, and we have to prepare for a fleet-on-fleet action and put more ships at sea.
I absolutely agree with you. Colonel Robert Wilkie, the former VA secretary, and as he said, he had a key role at the Pentagon in preparedness. Colonel Wilkie, it's a pleasure to have you on. Back in just a moment. You're listening to First Amendment Friday on the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's First Amendment Friday. Glad to be with you. And I want to share something with you. First, an email, and then I want to tell you about something that Jen Psaki was talking about today, because President Joe Biden made a rather amazing admission last night that he, as president of the United States, had called a hospital on behalf of a friend to get his friend's wife to the head of the line. And he worked this into some of his comments that he made today. I'll get to those in a moment. But Charles wrote to me, and it seems related. He says, Lars, I was talking to a surgery nurse from Riverbend Hospital in Eugene, Springfield this morning. She was forced to get the jab at work. She had an adverse reaction, blood clots in her lungs. She recovers and then returns to work. Now the hospital has canceled surgeries because of COVID protocols, and now she is vaxxed and out of work, given unpaid leave. Nice, huh? I've asked Charles if he can put me in touch with that young lady or that man, whichever it happens to be. It was a young lady, and see if she will come on the show and talk about that. Let me tell you about this, though. This I find kind of amazing. President Biden calls a hospital trying to get one of his personal friends or the wife of a personal friend to the head of the waiting line that produced an amazing exchange at the White House briefing room today before Jen Psaki and Peter Ducey from Fox News, who seems to be one of the few reporters who will actually press some really tough questions on Jen Psaki, the spokeswoman for Joe Biden. Take a listen to the exchange. Do we have that soundbite? Jen Psaki in the emergency room.
President Biden claims that he cold called a Pennsylvania hospital to ask the desk receiving nurse why it was taking so long for a good friend's wife to be seen. What happened next?
Well, the context of why the president told this story, which I think is important, and I promise I'll answer your question, is that he was expressing that hospitals, frontline workers, nurses, doctors in emergency rooms are still seeing and feeling the impact of the number of people who are unvaccinated, who are filling beds and in emergency rooms, ICUs, and it is preventing, in some cases, people who have other illnesses, who may be seeking treatment, who may be fearful of a heart attack, other people who might be going to the emergency room from getting the care that they need. I don't have any other update for the privacy of this individual.
But setting aside the privacy of the individual, how often does President Biden call around trying to help his friends cut the line?
That certainly was not his intention. He was not trying to do that. He was checking in on a friend.
And do you know if this particular hospital might have been having staffing shortages because they have a vaccine mandate and maybe some folks have had to leave because they didn't want to get vaccinated?
I would love for you to account for me where that is the issue at, over more so than the number of unvaccinated who are filling emergency rooms, filling ICU beds. That is the problem in hospitals across the country.
No, it's not. And I'll tell you what, anybody who lives in the Pacific Northwest knows that over the last couple of weeks, we have documented on this show, and even the mainstream media, the legacy media, have admitted that systems like, say, Legacy, got rid of 800 staffers. Now, I understand there may be a problem with shortage of personnel, although most of the hospitals, if they're up against a shortage of beds and a shortage of space, they have decided to defer elective surgeries. They put them off during the surge that came from all the COVID cases. But Jen Psaki is trying to make you believe that this is all about the unvaccinated because that is the meme the White House is pushing. I think this is just downright evil. She says, show me where in the country that we're having a shortage of staffing because of the vaccine mandates. I'll tell you what, Jen, how about Oregon and Washington? Good blue states. I mean, you ought to love them. You're a Democrat. Your boss is a Democrat. The governor of Oregon's a Democrat. The governor of Washington's a Democrat. And those Democrat governors said, we're going to press this mandate on behalf of Joe Biden, even though Joe Biden hasn't even written or caused his OSHA agency to write the actual rule that everybody is already obeying, even though it's not a rule and it'll probably get slammed down in court. And what happened? We have thousands of nurses, thousands of hospital personnel. Just legacy alone is 0.8 of 1,000 personnel who've been let go. That's what's caused the problem. And then she brushes off this question, and I thought it was a good one. I mean, Ducey's pretty good lately about asking tough questions in a tough way. How often does the president of the United States call around the country trying to bust the line for his friends? Now, you know, if Donald Trump had done that, the major media would have been screaming from the rooftop saying, how dare the president go out there and try to get special treatment for his friends? Joe Biden does it, and it's just he was checking in on a friend. That is a Jen Psaki lie. Let me read the president's actual words. Last night, I was on the telephone with a person at the emergency hospital ward in Pennsylvania because a good friend had called and he had rushed his significant other to the emergency room because this woman was having trouble breathing, had a high fever, could not catch her breath. They got her into the hospital. The waiting room was so crowded, things were so backed up because they couldn't even get her to be seen. So because I knew this person, I called. I called the desk receiving nurse and asked what the situation was. When Jen Psaki says he was just checking up on a friend, Joe Biden didn't say, I called my friend and asked, how's your wife doing? He called the hospital. He pulled a favor. And when the president of the United States calls a hospital and says, can you make sure that my friend's wife gets seen? That is calling in a favor. That's out of line. And the allegation that we're not creating a problem with the vaccine mandate in hospitals, you know that's not true. You got the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a First Amendment Friday. Always glad to get to your calls, and we will get to those. There are so many things to talk about on this First Amendment Friday. And this segment of the show is brought to you by NickShivers.com for an instant offer to sell your home immediately. No showing, no hassles. You pick the closing date. NickShivers.com for details. Before we talk to Lee Finna, who's a good friend, she's the director of the Center for Education, the Washington Policy Center, I want to bring up a name. I don't like the guy much, but he said something, and I want to be able to quote him. Mitt Romney, not a fan of Mitt Romney, glad he didn't become president. Did I vote for him? Yeah, because he was better than the alternative. But at one point during the campaign, and this is what a knucklehead he was, he actually said something very smart, and then like a lot of weaselly people, he tried to weasel out of it and say, you know, explain why he said it. He should have said, absolutely, I said it. And here's what he said. He was being asked about companies that end up firing people, you know, because in the private sector, Romney had been with a, you know, a big investment firm, and they would buy companies that weren't being run very well for a very good price, and then they'd straighten them out. And like any of you who've run a business, you understand if you have to straighten out a company, you may have to fire some people and you may have to hire some new people. And Romney made this comment. He's the only guy I've ever seen who's actually said it. He said, it's nice to be able to fire people. And of course, the mainstream media just went ballistic and went, ah, what do you mean it's nice to fire people? And yet I said to myself, you know, we've all had this happen. You have an insurance agent and he's not doing a very good job. You fire him or her. You have somebody who's doing a job for you at your workplace and they're doing a lousy job. And you, well, you may counsel them first, say, shape up your act or you're gone. And then if they don't, they're gone. Yes, it's nice to be able to fire people. That's not a mean statement. And when it comes to government, when government isn't doing its job, especially a very important job like education, you should be able to fire them. And guess what? A whole bunch of parents are now firing their local government-run failing schools. And Lee Finn has written about it for the Washington Policy Center. Lee, welcome back. And sorry I got so fired up on that. But yes, it is good to be able to fire people.
Thanks, Lars. Well, especially if the people are not doing the job that they're hired to do, like educate the children in front of them. I mean, it's ironic because now we have a situation where we're firing good teachers that are not getting vaccinated, while we won't fire bad teachers that are vaccinated.
So it makes no sense. I want you to tell the audience that's listening here in the Pacific Northwest on our RNW network, how many parents just in the state of Washington have decided to fire? And I know the mainstream media, Como King, Cairo, KGW, K2, those guys, they're not going to call it that. They'll kind of do a story where they say, oh, isn't this terrible? The public schools are losing all these students. No! Oh. You've got parents who fired the schools for doing a lousy job. How many parents have done that just in Washington State just this fall?
50,000 children have been pulled out of the public schools in Washington State by their parents. That's 5% of the total. That is as many children as the largest school district in Washington State, Seattle Public Schools. 50,000 students, that's about 100 schools worth of children. That's a big number of families who are unhappy with the public schools, who have seen what is on offer, who are dismayed by their worries that the public schools will not catch them up for the lost learning that they suffered during the COVID school shutdowns. They're dismayed by the politicization of the schools, by the, you know, the endless barrage of politics that are now coming at children from their teachers. Critical race theory, radical sex education curricula, all kinds of bad things for children. Families are very worked up about it. And I've never seen so many people pull their kids out of the schools, and I've never seen so many people running for school board, Lars.
I think it's fantastic. And now they can run on the campaign of saying, I'll be the kind of guy that Merrick Garland would send the FBI after for saying things at school board meetings. I think that might be a great campaign thing. But you put together a list of particulars. I want people to read the piece you posted to Washington Policy Center. You said the kids have lost 4 to 7 months of learning. Parents are angry about racial politics taking over the schools. The state's lowered the quality of instruction, maybe not as far as Oregon. Oregon actually says you can get a high school diploma even if you can't read, write, or count. Parents are angry about radical sex ed. They're upset about the governor's mask and vax mandates. They're firing the public schools. Now, here's the key question. Are the public schools getting the message in the same way that, say, a private business that sees 5% of its entire customer base say, we're not coming to your place, a grocery store, a restaurant, whatever, are they getting the message?
That's a good question. I'm concerned that they are being protected from getting the message because the last legislative session involved a bill where they were going to fund the empty seats that they expected to occur.
So, hold on. I want people to pay close attention. Literally, the schools went to the legislature and said, we're going to lose kids because we're doing a lousy job. And so we want you to pay for the kids that would have been in the seats if we hadn't done a lousy job. That's what they asked for.
And they got it. They asked for it and they got it for this school year. Now they're worrying about what comes the following school year. You see,
and so
what'd you say?
How about cut them off? Say, no, you did a lousy job. Look, what would happen on a private business leave if you had somebody work for, pick a company, a carpet cleaning company, and the boss comes down and says, you guys have been doing a lousy job on some of the carpet cleaning you're doing, and we've lost 5% of our customers. We used to have 1,000 customers. Now we got 950. And the workers say, I'll tell you what, we can just get by with the 950 customers. You pay us as though we were cleaning 1,000 customers' homes, but we're only going to clean 950, and you'll pay us as though we still had all those customers. You think that would go over well in any private business?
No, it doesn't go over well in reality, right? And that's why we call for focusing on what the purpose of education is, and that is getting the children educated. And so taking that money that would be given to the system and just giving it to parents so they can use it to hire tutors or pay private school tuition. We think that would, if we started doing that in Washington State and in Oregon, California, all of a sudden those district administrators would sharpen up what they're providing in the traditional public schools because they would fear losing their money to parents who go elsewhere. But as it is now, in this current school year, the school districts are not suffering any financial consequences from the decisions of 50,000 children leaving their schools. No financial consequences whatsoever.
I hope all those people running for school board get on the board, and I hope the first thing they say is, hey, you're the school administrator. We hired you. The board hired you. We gave you more money because of the McCleary decision, a lot of other things. We've given you billions of extra money. How far have you moved the needle? And if the superintendent says, I haven't moved the needle at all. In fact, it's moved back the other way. Say, guess what? Pack your stuff. You're out of here. You're fired. We're hiring somebody who can do the job. That's Lee Finna from the Washington Policy Center. Coming up next, Puget Sound ferries that don't leave the dock and why. And this is Happy First Amendment Friday to you. Glad to be with you throughout our Radio Northwest Territory. 21 years of serving Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. Now built up to 24 stations, and they are great affiliate stations all over all three of those states. Our Twitter poll today, should government gut the death penalty for the worst killers without even asking the voters? I'd say no to that. You can vote any way you like at Lars Larson Show or at LarsLarson.com. And brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Yesterday's poll had to do with that story I told you about from Ari Hoffman at the Post Millennial. A Seattle school where two people pulled up in a car, not once but twice, armed with an AR-15. No shots were fired. Students reported this. It happened in the middle of the noon hour as students were returning to the school. They told their teachers, which is the appropriate thing to do. The administration of the school had to call 911 because they no longer have a school resource officer, because the liberal elites who run the schools say, we don't want a cop on campus. He might actually arrest one of the students when that student commits a crime. I know it sounds crazy, but that's literally what they say. They also say, we don't like the school resource officers to arrest people because oftentimes they arrest more people of color, students of color, than they do majority students. And so that bothers them as well. So they get rid of the crime problem at the school by just taking away the law enforcement officer who might actually see the crime and take the child into custody or charge them appropriately under the law. I said, should we put the resource officers back in the schools? My answer to that is yes. So were 92% of you who voted in the poll. Only 8% said no. Let's go to your calls. And if you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. Dan, welcome to the program. Thanks for listening. What's on your mind today?
Thanks for taking my call, Lars. I just wanted to make a point that that the deal with the school boards, the school board association filing that complaint, I think it's terrible, but it really goes to fit with what they're doing with legislative sessions too, with where you can't, you know, they're not supposed to be holding session, I don't think, unless the people are in attendance.
They're not. Actually, it's not just not supposed to, Dan. In the state of Oregon, when the legislature met behind locked doors and locked the public out, and they said, well, but it's because of COVID. Well, the state constitution says the legislature cannot legislate, cannot pass new laws if the public is not allowed into the building to personally watch the process of legislation, which is a bit like making sausage, but there you go. You know, I had people say, but the governor has the right to say, we're going to lock up all the buildings and keep the public out during an emergency. I said, yeah, she does, perhaps. But when she does, if you say, if the building's locked up, can we still pass laws? You look at the Constitution, and it says no, then you don't pass any laws. And what the lawmakers said was, well, we still want to pass laws, even though we're not allowing the public in the building. And the answer is, you can't. The Constitution says you can't. And they just decided, well, we'll just go ahead and do it anyway. I mean, in a lot of ways, it's like the Biden administration. They've done a bunch. They've been slapped down hard three different times this year by the U.S. Supreme Court saying you can't do that. And they don't seem to get the message that, you know, when the law says you can't do it, then you can't do it. And Dan, I've compared this to what, sadly, a lot of 16-year-old boys do. They say, you know, if their friends say, hey, we're going to go out and we're going to climb on the roof of the school, or we're going to break into the school. And you go, but is that legal? And you say it is till we get caught.
Yeah, well, I guess the way we're headed with, you know, they'll just keep pushing the socialist deal until they keep, you know, keep getting more and more what they want. So
till we push back. until we push. And I suggest the pushback come right now. In fact, I think we should be inspired by Merrick Garland announcing he's going to send the FBI and the DOJ, send them off after parents who show up at school board meetings and complain loudly. Do you know that that letter that was sent by the National School Boards Association? If you take a look at it, not a single incident of any kind of criminal activity do they cite. What they're complaining about is our school boards are doing crazy things and the parents show up to complain, and sometimes they complain loudly. And you say, well, that's not illegal. In fact, it's constitutional free speech. And they say, yeah, but we don't like it when they complain. This is a bunch of whiny jerks, because if you're on a school board and you don't want to listen to parents objecting when you do crazy stuff, don't run for the school board. As Harry Truman used to say, if you can't stand the heat, get out of the kitchen. If you say, I want to be on a board where everything I and my fellow board members do, the public comes in and sings hosannas to us. And you go, good luck. You know, there isn't a single board like that in the entire world. And I know there's not one like it in America, because, you know, even if you are doing the right thing, there's going to be somebody who's going to object. And if you say, well, I don't want to hear their objections, lock them out of the room. That's not how we do representative government, frankly. Joe is a naysayer. Hey, Joe, welcome to the program. What's on your mind today?
Thanks, Lars. I'm going to disagree with you about putting police officers back in schools.
Go for it.
The reason I think the public schools need to spiral further out of control before the general public will pull their heads out and realize how bad it's gotten. It's unfortunate, but they're not going to recognize the need for police officers in the school until it spirals worse out of control.
Till we get some blood on the ground.
I hate to put it that way.
Well, but let's put it honestly, because I get what you're saying and I understand it. And what I always tell people who say, why don't we just let the whole thing crash and burn? And then people will realize what a problem this is, and they won't do it that way. The problem is the collateral damage, the real human damage, a lot of it, stuff that can't be fixed with dollars or you know, I mean, things like that. If you say, well, let's just let the whole thing spiral out of control. The problem is, how do you put it back together, especially if some of the damage that's done, if you take a kid as under critical race theory, which, by the way, Merrick Garland's son-in-law sells this propaganda to public schools. And do you think Merrick Garland should have disclosed that when he came out to object to parents showing up to complain about CRT?
Oh, yeah, but nobody's going to admit to anything until they get caught. That's the way the Democrats work.
Except that when you're at the level of an attorney general of the United States, how many nanoseconds does it take for people out there researching things to say, hold on a second, I've looked at his, and look, there's nothing wrong with this, Joe. If you were running for public office and you said, hey, find out about my opponent. Well, see what business your opponent's family is in. Say, well, family's off limits. No, it's not. Because if you're running for county commissioner and your brother-in-law runs an asphalt paving company, and all of a sudden all the county's roads are being paved by the company that your brother-in-law owns, that's a problem, isn't it?
Oh, I agree. No, family is not off limits. But with regard to the schools, until the sheeple figure out that the administration is less interested in education and more interested in making the Democrats and the liberals happy.
You're right. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, especially on a First Amendment Friday. Your phone calls and emails are welcome, and I will get to those calls a bit later. I've been telling you for quite a while that I think we're headed into an era in the next couple of years, at least, not an era, but the next couple of years, where energy is going to become increasingly in short supply. I'd point out to you that gasoline prices have now gone up dramatically just in the first less than a year that Joe Biden has been in office. And I would suggest that many of the things that President Biden has done, banning fracking, or he's planning to do it through the regulatory mechanisms, same thing. It doesn't matter if fracking can't be done anymore because of regulations or a law or an executive order. It doesn't really matter which one it is if you've stopped it. If you stop pipelines from being constructed, unless, of course, they benefit Vladimir Putin, in which case Joe Biden's completely in favor of them. I'm worried about energy turning into a luxury in America. So I've invited Gregory Wrightstone on, who's a geologist and the executive director of the CO2 Coalition in Arlington, Virginia. He's also written Inconvenient Facts, the science that Al Gore doesn't want you to know. Gregory, good to have you back.
Good to be back on with you, Lars. And just real quickly, I gotta do a little fist pump. My 4-year-old book is still ranked today number one bestseller on Amazon. So
congrats!
That book's got some legs. That shouldn't happen to a book.
No, it probably won't after this, because I'm sure that, you know, with this new YouTube ban and everything else, they're going to say, this Gregory Wrightstone, he's writing books that show skepticism toward the true believer global warming nonsense, so we can't allow him on social media. Stop selling him ads. But I still wish the best for you, despite the fact that I'm sure big tech will be coming after you. But have I overstated the case in saying that America, which should be energy self-sufficient, is going to head into energy shortages?
Well, it is. I think you might have it just a little bit wrong. I think it's going to come sooner than what you think. You said over the next several years. I think the chickens are going to come home to roost as early as this winter. It just depends what Mother Nature does for us. For example, right now, before I came on your show, I'm looking out my window in Arlington, looking at Theodore Roosevelt Island. There's not one leaf moving on the tree. I looked at it and I said, boy, that's strange. So I looked at the chart of the fuel mix for the Mid-Atlantic states. Mid-Atlantic states as of 3 p.m. Eastern this afternoon, less than 1/10. It was 0.7% of all the electricity being generated in the 13 Mid-Atlantic states and Washington, D.C. was by wind. 0.7%. But yet Joe Biden, with his calculations, by 2030, he expects wind to generate 50% to 60% of the electricity. It's a pipe dream, and I'm telling you, there are a lot of indications that this could be a heck of a winter coming in. If it is, and very cold, we're going to see repeats of Texas. We're going to see happening right now in the UK with natural gas prices and the electricity prices 5 times what they were a year ago. We see gasoline prices in the United States double what they were a year ago, and it's all by design. He was begging, Biden is begging the OPEC and Saudi Arabia to open up the pumps and pump more oil to get that price down, while he's doing everything he can in the United States to curtail production. He's banned production in the Gulf of Mexico, which supplies 10%. He banned the XL pipeline. It just doesn't make sense. And we've got this wonderful resource here in the United States.
Are the Saudis
gas and fracking?
Well, Greg, are the Saudis and the other OPEC nations, it's not just the Saudis or the Middle East, I think Venezuela is part of it, are they just laughing all the way to the bank saying, we can't believe it, the United States is self-sufficient for oil, self-sufficient for natural gas, self-sufficient for coal. Half the coal in the world is burned by the Chinese, which apparently is okay with Joe. And the United States has cut itself off from its own supply and is now begging other producers on the planet to produce something we have in abundance. This is this is nuts, isn't it?
It's beyond nuts. The week that Joe Biden was inaugurated, it was the first week since 1985 that the United States did not import one barrel of oil from Saudi Arabia. We the week he was elected, we just achieved energy independence. We broke that dependency on the Middle East and Saudi Arabia. And on that same day, he does everything he can to put to throw a monkey wrench in the works. It angers me what he's done now, what his plans are to change that dependency from the Middle East on energy to a dependency on China. Frankly, I'd rather be dependent on Saudi Arabia and the Middle East for my energy than it would be from China. If we look at it, because again, China's going to be developing the critical minerals that are needed for his all-electric America, cobalt, lithium, and bear in mind, Afghanistan holds huge reserves of lithium. and all these critical minerals, 80% of which are thought to be processed in China. The cobalt that's needed, 80% is mined in the Congo using child labor and then shipped to China for processing. So it's this whole thing is contaminated from the mining to the processing, and it all goes through China.
Well,
President Xi must be just rubbing his hands together in glee.
Well, I'm just wondering, see, I'm one of those people who believes that Hunter Biden got millions of dollars from Chinese companies, which I think we know it did. He saved some aside for the big guy. And I've said Joe Biden's bought and paid for by the Chinese communists. And now he's paying it back to them. And he's also, I mean, for all the nonsense I had to listen to about Trump and Russia, which turned out to be a bunch of hooey, even according to the Democrats' favorite guy, Robert Mueller, Joe Biden did Western Europe a dirty and a favor to Putin by saying, you can go ahead and build this Nord Stream pipeline, which puts Western Europe at risk of, you know, all Putin's got to say is we're cutting off the natural gas, and he cuts it off, and all of a sudden Western Europe, our buddies, are in trouble. Whereas what he could have said was, we've got lots of natural gas in the United States. We're going to build some more LNG export ports, and we're going to ship you all the nat gas you want to buy, and it'll benefit Americans, it'll benefit Western Europe, and it'll poke Putin in the eye.
Yeah, yeah. And what most people don't realize are how vast the reserves are of natural gas in the United States. I was a co-author of the first peer-reviewed paper on the Marcellus Shale, which stretches across the Northeast. It's the largest natural gas field by far in the world, and we've just begun to exploit it. The reserves there, there are actually three different shale layers. All of them are considered super giants. And I coined the term mega giant to describe both the Utica Shale and the Marcellus Shale in the eastern part of the United States. We're going to be able to produce gas there for probably generations to come.
And we're going to simply lock it up underground and then buy from, well, not nat gas, but oil from other people. This just seems insane. I mean, I live in the Pacific Northwest, Gregory. We got trees to beat the band up here. And it reminds me of somebody who owns, say, inherited 1,000 acres of woodland, you know, of trees from his granddad. And then he goes out and buys cordwood for his fireplace from somebody else. And his supplier would say, why are you buying cordwood when you've got 1,000 acres of trees? Oh, no, I don't want to use my trees. I want to buy them from you. I mean, the Saudis must be just think we're absolutely nuts. His book, still a bestseller, as Greg mentioned, is Inconvenient Facts, the science that Al Gore doesn't want you to know. He's the executive director of the CO2 Coalition, based, as he said, in Arlington, Virginia, where, by the way, the wind is not blowing and it's not producing energy. Gregory, thank you so much. I appreciate you taking the time. This is the question you've got to ask yourself. Even if you voted for babbling Joe Biden, even if you want to put up with his malaprops and everything else that goes with him and not seeming to know what's going on, do you really want to this winter be paying a lot more money for energy, a lot more to fill your car or truck, or do you want America to be energy self-sufficient? We were on the day Joe Biden took the oath of office. We'll be back in just a moment. You've got the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's First Amendment Friday. Glad to be with you live on the Radio Northwest Network. And this segment of the show brought to you by Marquee Hot Tubs. They'll give you the ultimate hot tub and swim spa experience. Visit online or one of their three locations. Online, MarqueeHotTubs.com. Now, earlier this week, I talked to a young lady who specializes in farming, and she said the Washington State Legislature literally is trying to, you know that they're trying to force you out of gasoline and diesel-powered cars and trucks, but they're also going after farmers, and they're suggesting that maybe we should make the farmers use electric tractors, which we all kind of laughed at and said this is kind of ridiculous, although, like I say about every kind of technology, if they can come up with something that actually does the job and does it economically, I'm fine with that. And then somebody sent me, I kid you not, John Deere. And I'm a big admirer of John Deere. I've used their products for a long time. John Deere Tractors has come up with a tractor. It's a professional farming tractor. It's not for the happy homeowner. But it literally has an electric tractor, but they dropped off. In any case, the picture is ridiculous. because it shows a tractor, and it's real. It's not from the Babylon Bee or something, but it's John Deere with their new electric-powered tractor that has an extension cord on it that is two-thirds of a mile long, 1 kilometer, and it winds up on a big spool. It even has a system to make sure that the tractor does not run over its own electric extension cord, which... Having owned an electric lawnmower at one point in my life decades ago, I don't think it was a Craftsman, it was a different one, but it ran on electricity, and there was a reason, a specific reason, that I decided to buy one like that, not because of green stuff. You can actually run over your own extension cord with the lawnmower, and it does not have a good result. I can tell you that personally. In any case, let's go to your calls at 866-HEY-LARS and start with Kyle. Hey, Kyle, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network.
Hey, Lars, big fan. Been listening a long time now.
Thank you.
I just wanted to know if you'd heard anything about this Bud Pierce. He's running for Oregon governor, possibly might be right there neck and neck with a Democrat.
Well, we've talked to him. Well, Dr. Pierce is a good guy.
Oh, okay, perfect. I only get to catch part of your show from time
to
time.
No worries.
I don't get off till 3, so I only get to, the last maybe hour of it.
No worries. Bud Pierce is running. The primary election for governor is May of next year in Oregon, and then the general will be in November, as usual, and Bud Pierce is one of the Republicans who's running. And in fact, I have to tell you something, Kyle. We had talked to Dr. Pierce right before his wife was killed tragically in an accident. She was walking down the street in her neighborhood. She was hit by a car. She died. And we waited a long time because I wasn't sure what Dr. Pierce was going to do, because we can all put ourselves in his shoes. We'd hate to do it, but, he lost his wife very unexpectedly, and we weren't sure if he was still going to go ahead and run for governor, but he decided that he would, and we've talked to him since then as well. I think we're going to have a good slate of candidates, whereas on the Democrat side, you've got people like the very dishonest Tina Kotek, and Tobias Reed, the treasurer, who's constantly sending out woke messaging. I wish those candidates would actually come on the show so I could ask them a few reasonable questions. Reasonable but tough.
Yeah, that'd be a good naysayer there.
I would think so. And Kyle, wouldn't you, this is what always floors me, Kyle, because when I started doing this show 25 years ago, I said during every election season, both Oregon and Washington and Idaho, we'll entertain candidates from every corner of the, the political universe. So we'll talk to Republicans, Democrats, Independents, Libertarians, the rest. And I always thought the best way to show the strength of your argument, I mean, if you're in the private sector and you have a great idea and you go to the head of your company and he says, well, come to our board meeting and make a presentation to the board of directors. I would think Kyle, you'd say, well, that's a great idea because you're going to face some tough questions. But if you've really fine-tuned
Absolutely.
Your idea, the best way to show what a great idea is to have a whole bunch of people who may or may not like you or like the idea. But if you walk in there and say, here's my idea, and they say, well, what about this? And you say, I've got an answer to that. And you answer all their questions. What better way to sell your idea?
Good argument, yeah.
But, I don't always get, We get Democrats on occasionally. They're always invited. And I'll tell you something. I'd said for decades that the best way to run for a public office would be to use free media. And people say, what do you mean? You got to buy ads. I said, if you started calling every talk show in whatever, if you're running for a statewide office, call every talk show in the state or the region. If you're running for national office, get on every media you can get on. So what did Donald Trump do? He went out, ran for president. He was on CNN. He was on Fox. He was on MSNBC. He said yes to almost everybody. And they got him on thinking, well, we're going to slice and dice this guy. We're going to take him apart. And then they found out they couldn't do it. And then they couldn't resist the idea of putting him on, because every time they put him on, their audience would say, either I hate the guy or I love the guy. It didn't matter which, because the media got a lot of attention because Donald Trump was on. Now, you don't see CNN with the guts to put Donald Trump on now, but when they put him on, their ratings went up. And guess what? The American public got to hear from the guy in a way in which he didn't have to buy all that expensive media. You're listening to First Amendment Friday.